Okay, well, we're a little light on attendance right now, but why don't we get started? The purpose of this morning, this call is being recorded, and you can turn on the recording. The purpose of this call is to talk about the IRP. Caboos, who is not in Adobe Connect yet, has something he'd like to say at the beginning, so I will turn to Caboos, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I apologize, everyone, that's not having connections. I'm not respecting the queue. Becky, we have started discussing everything from 15th of January up to end of April. We have discussed in detail many things. It is not the time that we have new ideas. It is the time that we have new notions. Just we have to rectify any inconsistencies or any difficulties and remove that. I understood that the people start to have new ideas, and it is not productive. It is not productive 1 week before the public comment. So we have to refrain from that. This is one point. And the other point is the IRP, and with respect to the GATT advice. You know that if the GATT makes advice, this advice goes to the board. And if the board does not agree with that, they have to discuss. Once they discuss it, and they have to find a solution. But if the community or ICANN put it to the IRP, and if it is a binding, the rights of the GAC will be removed to have a negotiations with the board. These negotiations with the board is fundamental for the GAC for the advice because of the public policy issue. We should be very careful when dealing with RIT and binding approach or binding aspects of that with respect to the GAC advice. This is an important point. I'm sure that you will receive formal comments from all GAC, but I want to raise this issue at this stage to be very, very clear. This is one point. And the second is what you mentioned yesterday, saying that all advisory committees should have equal rights. Yes, everybody should have equal rights. But with respect to the GAC, there is a special right of the GAC for the advice, and that was not properly addressed. You told me that I misunderstood. I hope I misunderstood you. But I stand to be corrected when I see the final text that this very right of GAC is maintained. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboos. I think your point about new ideas and making sure we get our work done is very well taken. I think that you will see when you see the final text that the right of GAC with respect to engagement with the board on public policy advice is preserved. I think that we do have to address the GAC's concerns about binding, although I would just say it's a sort of difficult issue because if the IRP only addresses places where ICANN has acted or failed to act in violation of the bylaws, and if ICANN has no ability, as I think we understand, it has no ability to follow advice that would require it to violate the bylaws, there's a little bit of a bind there. But why don't we move into the discussion about the independent review? And let me preface it by saying this is a, you know, getting this right, the rules, et cetera, is going to be complicated. We need to make sure those rules are correct. We need to put forward for Workstream 1 the shape of the independent review, what its authority, the basic issues, and then talk about what process gets used to create the rules of the road and the detailed rules for the court. I have been thinking that it would be a subset of the CCWG aided by experts in constitutional law and international law. Because although there are plenty of lawyers on the CCWG, I don't think that we have expertise in the judicial function in quite the way that we would need. So I am thinking that we have a resolution creating that committee, or maybe it's just a subgroup of the CCWG, but we have some kind of guarantee from ICANN about the constitutional and international law support, and address the details in that way. Does anybody have any thoughts or ideas on that, David?
Sorry, I had to get off mute there. Becky, excuse me. I would just like to say I largely agree with the way that you just put that. That is that for the workstream one, we'll come up with basically the outline of the court, the things that you have on the document right here in front of us, and that a committee of sorts would be created to go to the details. I like that idea, and I certainly like the idea that rules of procedure, for instance, would be decided by that group rather than by an independent panel itself. I just want to say with respect to the idea of the skills we're looking for, international law sounds to me to be right on, but constitutional expertise, I would say, maybe would be better expressed as corporate governance expertise. And I think that's probably what that word constitutional means in this context, but that's what I would say in that respect. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Greg?
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. I'm also kind of thrown by the term constitutional in this context, and also looking at the document in front of us, referring to a constitutional court. Apologies for maybe being a little behind the curve on this particular aspect of our work, but I don't see where that terminology came from and why it's appropriate in this case at all. So I'm not sure quite what it is we're looking for, but I don't think the word constitutional just strikes me as being incorrect in some fashion.
Okay, let me just explain that. First of all, I don't have any investment in that word. It was just there was a comment, Host and Keel comment, who warned against. If anybody's not talking, could you put your phone on mute, please? That it be charged with really determining whether ICANN has acted or failed to act in violation of its bylaws. And then hearing claims involving statutory rights of the sole member. So I'm fine just removing that term, if that makes people happy, so long as people are comfortable with the role that the task that the court is charged with carrying out. Greg?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I think I'd like to remove that term and then figure out what it is we're really trying to refer to, distinguish this from the current IRP. It sounds like this is this just intended to be the current IRP plus more things, plus the binding nature of things, or is it intended to be an entirely different recourse?
Well, I think of it as an enhancement to the existing IRP plus a community right to act, to use the IRP plus claims involving statutory rights or other rights of the member. So it is a little bit plus, but that involves it's largely the community mechanism and the dispute between ICANN and its members.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well, which is why it seems a little odd to kind of throw in kind of some, you know, new terminology to what's basically just an enhancement of an existing recourse that we have. And in that regard, again, I'm sorry for being sick, but not entirely sure what the problem is for the GAC, since assumably the GAC could take advantage of the current IRP. Why are we now having a big problem that requires international law experts?
Well, I don't know. I think we need some expertise in the international dispute resolution, not necessarily arbitration. So let's get to the GAC issue on the bindingness just in a second. David?
This is Aubrey. Can I get in the queue? I'm not online. Thanks.
Oh, okay. I'm going to recognize David and then Aubrey.
Thank you. Just since you mentioned it, Becky, in paragraph number one, you know, that the enhanced IRP will be hearing claims involving statutory rights, I simply wanted to make a statement with respect to that phrase, that we make sure that the standard that the IRP is going to be working to is uniformly stated. In other words, in one section we say that it's looking at claims that ICANN has violated its bylaws, which I think is the right standard. And then adding the idea of claims involving statutory rights of the sole member, I think it would be a good idea that we ask the lawyers to ensure that the statutory rights of the sole member meshes, you know, uniformly with the violation of the bylaws standard that we're adopting, so that we don't sort of confuse ourselves. And that's my statement. Thank you.
That's a very good point. I think that what we will refer to is rights of the sole member in the under the bylaws, which will include whatever mandatory statutory rights there are. And I'll make that consistent throughout. Aubrey?
Yeah, thanks. This is Aubrey speaking. Sorry, I've just gotten online. I was on phone walking from one place to another. In terms of international, being that we're seeing these as basically functions, and I thought I heard someone in there reference these are functions and capabilities and not new panels, I think that international one is critical in that so many of the issues that we're going to be dealing with going forward are in relationships and in interpretations of obligations under bylaws and such with from an international perspective, that as an international organization, we absolutely have to have that. And I disagree that it has anything to do with the GAC. It has as much to do with CCTLDs as anything, in fact, perhaps even more. And as we have more diversity and more IDNs and more, we will have far more international issues that need to be properly understood and resolved. Thanks.
Thank you. And that's a very good point, because obviously one of ICANN's obligations under its bylaws is to comply with international law. So that's another reason that we need that. Okay. David, is that a new hand or an old hand? I'm going to assume it's an old hand. Welcome, Kavuz. I see you're in the room now. Moving on to the standing. We have any person or entity materially harmed by action or inaction in violation of bylaws, the community acting through the sole member, and the thresholds for that are to be determined. The process will provide for interlocutory relief, so if you demonstrate a likelihood of material harm, the court would be able to step in preserve the space going forward. The one thing that I wanted to raise here is a question of whether we should specifically say that ICANN will not, by contract, deprive any party of its rights to bring an independent review. We used the contract. We saw the contract for, the rules for the new applicants. They required applicants to give up their rights to go to court. I'm just a little concerned that we may need something clear here, and it also. For contracted parties, there is an arbitration provision in the contract, but it doesn't exactly go to the violation of the bylaws. Cavus?
Yes, I now have Adobe connection, and I wish to comment on some of the comments made. Some colleagues mentioned that GATT should not take advantage of RP. How he came to that conclusion, that GAC is an entity looking to taking advantage of something. I don't think that any of the community would intend to take advantage of anything. This is something, a motion that I don't agree with that. I don't agree with such a motion that people being suspicious with GAC and we should withdraw this sort of thinking and be neutral, impartial, and fair to everybody. So I cannot agree with that statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. With all due respect, I actually think you misunderstood, and I'm not quite sure. It was either Greg or David. I think what they were saying was that the GAC was entitled to use the IRP process, and the term take advantage of in colloquial American English is not necessarily the negative derogatory reference that I think that you heard. So I think the clarification is that that the GAC is entitled, as all parts of the community are, to take advantage of, to avail themselves of the independent review process. So I hope that clears things up. David?
Becky, thank you. I would just like to respond to your idea of making it clear, that ICANN cannot by contract deprive a party of the ability to go to IRP. I like that idea. I also think somewhere it would be good to provide, whether this group does or the subgroup that's going to come up with the process, that to provide for the fact that when people go to an IRP, both ICANN and the complainant or whoever it is, they both sign an agreement that they will abide by the terms of by the judgment of the IRP, and the claimant, I don't think, should be able to go to court if they lose. In other words, I don't think they should be able to go to court to an appeal. And so I like your idea, and so I wanted to get on record and say that. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Ed?
Yeah, Becky, as well, I want to support your idea of having somewhere in what we're doing the idea that ICANN cannot use contract to bypass the IRP. As you know, some of us in the GNSO believe they're starting to do that with the Dutch travel example, using contract to bypass the PDP. So it'd be good to stop that practice regarding the IRP before it starts. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments on this thread? Cavus, can I ask if we have clarified your concern regarding the phrase take advantage of? Okay. I see a very, very long post from Rafael. Would you like to your mic is not functioning. Okay, so let me just read this. So you were talking about the prospective release where damage cannot be proved as something that has happened, but it's likely to happen. The standing provides that there is an interlocutory, that there's a injunctive remedy. So somebody who can demonstrate that there is a likelihood that they would be harmed, materially harmed, will be able to invoke the IRP process. That is clearly intended, and there's some language in the report that speaks to that in greater detail. This is just a bullet point. So I believe, Raphael, that we have absolutely addressed this concern, but if not, hopefully you will let us know when you get audio, and I hope somebody's working on the audio issue for you. Okay, in terms of the selection process, we heard a lot from the community about the board involvement and various independence issues. We also heard a lot from the community about the need to distinguish this from sort of standard international commercial arbitration. And therefore, the notion was that asking international arbitration bodies to nominate folks would be, potential panelists would be counterproductive. So what we discussed in Paris was that there would be a tender process for an organization that would provide administrative support, help us issue a call for expressions of interest, soliciting applications from well-qualified candidates with the goal of securing diversity, and doing an initial review and vetting of applications against established criteria. So in some ways, this is like a specialized headhunter firm that is really looking at sort of judicial expertise around the globe, and it would be working with the community to solicit applications and, you know, issue a call for applications, get those applications, do a basic review. Then the community would select the proposed manners and an overflow pool. And it says on this paper process to be designed through the CCWG that can be part of WP2, although it needs to be an early part of WP2. And then once the panel and the overflow or alternative pool was determined by the community, it would go to the board for confirmation, and the board would have the right to object to a member, a proposed member of the panel based on, you know, a conflict of interest or something like that, but stated reasons, not just because. How do people feel about that, David?
Thanks, Becky. In your discussion, you mentioned, I like the process, but in your discussion, you mentioned that we'd almost be in the nature of looking for a judicial headhunter. So that brings up a point under number three and number four that I would like to talk to, and that is the fact that we're looking for significant legal expertise. And I would like to float the idea that maybe what we're looking for is some legal experience, but I I have served as an arbitrator in a number of three-member panels in my career, and one of the things I found is it doesn't take a lawyer to be a really good arbitrator. There are many engineers and other disciplines that come at this with the discipline needed and the understanding and the expertise, et cetera, to be a good arbitrator or decider. And so I worry a little bit. This is what I'm actually sort of expressing, a worry a little bit that the panel will be a bunch of lawyers, which is fine. But I just think we're narrowing the ability to pick up good people. And I would urge us to think maybe it need not be all lawyers. Maybe we should think of a way to look for people that have expertise in this area but go beyond the legal field. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because I think that what we put out in the first report and have been talking about throughout this is panelists who have legal expertise and who are supported and aided by technical or any governmental, diplomatic, whatever kind of expertise is needed. I mean, I guess this now I'm speaking not as the rapporteur, but my personal opinion. I think that there are, people who have helped countries put together, court judicial systems, who have just in terms of the headhunter part of it, who have a particular kind of expertise that in judicial systems that I think we are going to need to set this up correctly and to not make mistakes. And I don't disagree. I mean, we could have panelists, who are not lawyers, although to me it does seem like a particular, legal analysis of whether I can violate its bylaws. Other views on that? I see that Matthew, that should be, that the skill set should be broadened. And having individuals with arbitration skills would be useful. I think that is that's a given, Matthew. I think the question here is whether we're going to change the standard that we have had for panelists since the first report, which is significant legal expertise for panelists and then expertise also in the workings and management of the DNS, and then access to skilled technical, business, diplomatic, regulatory, or other experts upon request. And Greg, I see your point about arbitration, and I agree we can put that in. Okay. Not quite sure how we want to resolve. Okay, David, we'll move on. I take it from the lack of hands that people are comfortable with the selection process as it is, and the expertise. In terms of the diversity, there is a question that we need to address. The standard in the initial report is reasonable efforts to ensure cultural, linguistic, gender, and legal tradition diversity. Some of the comments we received said that we should place some kind of hard requirement and something like no more than two panelists from any individual ICANN region. That is a discussion point that I'm interested in hearing views on. Should we make it that, and there are two ways to handle it. One, we can make that an absolute, or two, we can say as that reasonable efforts, for example, striving to ensure that no more than two panelists are from any one ICANN region. David?
Thanks, Becky. It seems to me that since the group we're trying to fill is seven, sufficiently small, that it should be easy to fill this from all five regions, and the idea of a cap of two seems good. I recognize Jonathan's point that he put in the chat that some regions are pretty big, and I assume there's some very well-qualified folks that we may want to get, but this should, I think, at least be a goal. So I think it makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. Others? Okay. There seems to be Greg?
Hi, Greg Shatton for the record. I think it's reasonable efforts is good, but a hard cap or minimum concerns me because we don't know how many applicants we're going to get or how many people we're going to reach out and find for this. And I think that diversity has to be secondary to skill set. So if it can be satisfied, if diversity can be satisfied while having first-rate people with in terms of the skill set, I'm sure everybody's a first-rate person will apply in some fashion, but I would not want us to have a situation where we have to kind of make do because the system that we're using didn't yield a highly qualified individual from a given region. And I'm not thinking of any given region, but I think the choices have to be made with an eye toward diversity, but also an eye, two eyes toward merit. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Ed?
Yeah, I would echo what Greg is saying in terms of having sort of a SOC requirement. And of the categories we're looking at for diversity, I'm more concerned about the legal tradition diversity. Having been grown up in a common law country, but having my legal education in the civil law country, there's a different way of thinking among lawyers in both traditions. And I really think we need to prioritize that even a bit more than the geographic diversity.
Thank you. I think at some level, the geographic diversity is going to help us in the legal tradition diversity, but not it's not surefire, so I understand that as well. Okay, so what I'm hearing support for is reasonable efforts and a soft goal of no more than two panelists from any ICANN region. And unless there are objections to that, we'll move on. Greg and Ed, you guys both have your hands up. Are they old hands or new hands? Okay, they're old hands. Okay. We've been saying since the beginning it would be a seven-member standing panel. I think that the board raised some questions about capacity constraints with a seven-member panel. So in Paris, I floated the idea of having a pre-vetted pool of overflow or alternative panelists that can be brought in any situation. They would be, pre-vetted by the community. They wouldn't be on a standing payroll. They would be, paid on a per-case basis. And in all cases, at least the chair would be a member of the standing committee. Does that and then, we talked about individual panels of three decision makers in any case, and then that would be appealable. Their decision would be appealable to the full panel on an abuse of you know, a standard that is, you know, sort of manifest. You got the facts wrong, or you know, you got the law just clearly wrong. First, I want to ask if everybody's comfortable with the pre-vetted alternatives idea. I am not seeing I'm not seeing any hands in objection. Okay. I think Caboose is indicating in the chat that this is the place to discuss the concerns of the GAC with respect to whether a decision is binding or not, and if somehow that would undermine the GAC's ability to exercise its right under Article 11 to engage in constructive engagement with the board. I just want to remind people that the decisions of the independent review panel will not be a directive in the sense that if ICANN has, if a panel determines that ICANN has violated its bylaws, the declaration will be that ICANN has violated its bylaws. The panel will not specify the manner in which ICANN must fix that violation. And so the decision of the panel would go back to ICANN. It would say, you've violated your bylaws, and then ICANN would have the obligation to come up with a solution. So one response I have is that because the panel's decisions are not, you know, do not tell ICANN how to fix something, just that it must. There's a consultation opportunity there, as there is in advance. The other comment we had was that decision that the United States government, in their contribution to the GAC compilation, also said, you know, maybe there should be some test period when we see whether it's binding or not, or maybe there should be some out for, you know, truly, clearly, you know, off-the-wall decisions. Don't know exactly how we make that work. Greg?
Greg Chatton, for the record. This is on a relatively minor point of what you just and went through, and not necessarily on the question you just asked. But the idea that the standing panel, or that the panel that's making a decision, can't indicate how ICANN should act in response to its decision that the bylaws were violated, seems perhaps unduly narrow. I think in the Dot Africa decision there was some discussion of that, but I haven't been through that whole decision. But I think the idea that at the end of all of this the answer is either yes or no, but they can't say anything more than that. I'm not sure that that's how we want to constrain the panel after months of looking at the issues closely.
Okay, there's language that the attorneys have provided, I think, that is in the first report that I don't have in front of me, but I don't think it's just a yes or no. It's a, you know, they would provide their rationale for why the decision was wrong, and that would be part of the record. Other comments? Cavus has indicated in the chat that the GAC has established a working group to examine this issue, and that's great. Obviously, you know, we would be delighted to answer any questions that the working group might have. I think it's important to avoid any misconceptions or misconstructions or misunderstandings about this. So to the members of the GAC who are on the call, I want to affirmatively reach out to you and say that, you know, this group and individual members of it are available to, you know, to provide any answers to questions that the GAC may have. We still need to get to, I think we still need to talk a little bit about just the binding, non-binding issue here. The community seems quite strongly in support of the notion that this would be binding, you know, to the extent that it can be, and there are some issues for which it probably cannot be binding, but those are pretty narrow. But we do have these concerns about unintended consequences from the GAC that we should talk about. David and then Greg.
Thank you, Becky. I put my hand up back when we were also talking about the U.S. government suggestion about possibly having a test period, and I think it has some surface appeal. I just don't know how it would work because for a couple of reasons. One is there's no guarantee that there'll be a lot of IRP cases. It seems like the new GTLD program spurred a lot of IRP cases. But even if there are, the cases take some time to adjudicate anyway. South Africa was an exception by being so long, but they're still going to take some time. So I just don't know how that would work, and I wonder about that. On the binding question, I like the idea of binding, but I know that the lawyers have weighed in on some limitations on that, and we need to look at that language, at least I need to look at that language again and see what it is. But I like the idea that that this will be a real remedy and will not be the same old IRP that just looks at process and is advisory only. That simply didn't work and wasn't good. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg?
Sorry, I'm trouble getting off mute there. I think that the binding issue, as I say, is something for which there's broad support. I see that, you know, we say under it's kind of trapped under size, but it probably should be put under exhaustion or something else that is appealable to the full panel, so that there is a form of appeals here. So if there is somehow a bonehead decision, I guess you have to decide what the right of appeal means and whether that's a right to appeal by both ICANN and by the complainant, or is it only the complainant? In my mind, it should be both. So if ICANN disagrees with the panel, it has some recourse. But the issue of binding, I don't see how that, you know, relates to the GAC issue. So I have no idea why Caboose is saying that the IRP is entirely different from dispute resolution. So I don't understand what the difference would be, unless it's the point that this would be or could be a court of international or could be considered an arbitral body under international law and allow for further use of courts to enforce a decision. If that's where we're going, I think that's kind of a particular discussion that we have to have as to whether there is recourse to the courts. And I think clearly an aspect of this being binding is that it's enforceable through external processes. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. So, yes, we do have a process that says it can be appealable to the full panel, and I think Holly or Rosemary suggested a standard for that, which I will circulate to the group, and we can get some discussion on that. And Caboose is saying we do not want to be hostage to California court, and so I just want to clarify that what Greg was referring to was not any substantive decision by a California court, but in any of these processes, if you have a binding decision, so say there's a binding decision that goes in favor of the complainant, and ICANN says, nope, we're not going to do that, and they don't have a good reason for it, at that point, the person who has won the decision at the IRP level could go to a court and ask the court to enforce the decision of the panel. But that is all that it would be doing. It's not. It does not have anything to do with basically except saying to ICANN, you must abide by the decision of the panel. So I don't think that this is in any way holding ICANN or the community hostage to California court. It's really just invoking a California court to support an ICANN process that the community has agreed on. And as David points out, it need not be in California. Any court that has jurisdiction over ICANN, and there are quite a lot of them, could bring that. So I hope that addresses your concern, Caboose, because this is another point on which I think there's been misunderstanding. Greg, is your hand a new hand? No. Okay. Caboose is asking in the chat whether the GAC members are participating. If you're in the room, I think you can see the participants. Caboose and Finn Pearson is here from Denmark. Okay. The independence issue, I think there are certain standards things that are pretty easy to do, but let's just talk about the term, what we think the term should be. And I believe that we have called for a single term as opposed to the opportunity for reappointment. So that, in my mind, sort of pushes us to a slightly longer rather than shorter term. But we need to have a view on that. And also the time limits on pre-existing and post-term limits on relationship with ICANN. So how independent do they need to be coming into the process, and for how long after the after their term do they need to remain independent? Any views on that? No view. Oh, David. Okay, great.
Just to throw something out there, Becky, it would strike me that for purposes of pre-existing and post-term limits, maybe 2 years would be a good period.
Okay.
One year seems too short. With respect to the term, I would suggest 3 years, just like a director. But I did hear you say maybe longer. Maybe tied into this is there, and to the idea of removal and recall, should be the idea that the community, not the board, but the community, should have, maybe like an ATRT, should have a periodic review that the court or that the IRP is sticking to what its job is and is not, as Aubrey said the other day, is not a group of people running around looking for something important to do. And that happens with judicial panels. They create something out of whole cloth that is just beyond. I just think the community needs some way to watch that the panel is sticking to what its job is. And so I think that relates to some of this. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think that's actually a really great idea, so thank you and Aubrey for raising it. Clearly, you know, because this is, and I think this goes to the U.S. government's concern about, you know, sort of a test period. Clearly, that is that's an important issue. I guess I was thinking of like a 4-year term as opposed to a 3-year term, but you know, I could be obviously the first panel would have to be staggered. So, yeah, Greg is saying there should be a periodic review of the IRP functions. That seems absolutely sensible. And David is okay with 4 years. Anybody else? So shall we go with 4 years and 2 years? Okay. On the question of exhaustion, what we would want is measures designed to encourage participation in a policy development process and disincentives to sit out or game the process. And I think that is something that that set of requirements could be fleshed out by the ongoing group, the sort of IRP subgroup aided by experts. But I think that's pretty clear idea. That makes a lot of sense. Somebody who is part of the community shouldn't just sit on the sidelines while a policy development process is going on and then complain about it afterwards. On the other hand, there could be surprises and things that we have to account for. David, is your hand a new hand?
It's a new hand, but it was simply to ask Caboose. I think he made a point in the chat that might be a good one about invoking IRP during a time when the same question is pending before an IRP. And if so, I think there's the potential for that, especially in a time of a new GTLD program or something like that, is pretty important. And so I was hoping Caboose might be a little bit more explicit about what he's asking. Thank you.
Caboose? Until Caboose rejoins us, I do think that there are some important issues about sort of consolidating different cases. I mean, you wouldn't want two IRPs to be dealing with exactly the same issue. and the possibility that they could come out in different ways, although, of course, you could then have all of those cases go up to the full panel. But there also needs to be some provision for directly affected parties to be part of the process, even if they're not one of the complainants. So I think that, you know, the current IRP did not permit the African Union to participate in the IRP brought by Dot Connect Africa. Clearly, they are directly and immediately affected party, and seems like we would want to have some joinder and interpleader rules here as part of the process that would get put together by the group. And I agree with David that these are questions for the subgroup, but we should flag them as questions. So we will definitely do that. Okay. In terms of exhaustion, so that again will be fleshed out. Settlement efforts, I think we would just go with the CEP, but we would permit any party at any time in that process to invoke formal mediation to move the process along. The nature of the decision, we've already talked about. As to the binding, the standard that we have now is that three-member decisions are binding, subject to appeal to the full panel and subject to a carve-out for matters so material to the board that would undermine its statutory obligations and fiduciary roles. Ed?
Thanks, Becky. Yeah, can we quickly go back up to number 9? I guess my question is there any reason we want to keep the CEP around? I mean, I love mediation. Parties are certainly free to try to settle outside of formal structures. And my experience with the CEP is it's highly biased towards ICON. And if we're going to have mediation as an option, I really don't see the necessity of continuing to have it.
Well, is it a problem if any party can just say, we don't want to do it? I mean, some parties may want CEP, based on what I've heard.
Okay. If there's some, I didn't realize there was some support for it, so I guess that's fine. It's just I can't imagine anybody wanting to go through it, but I guess that's just my view. Okay, thanks.
No, I mean, what I meant to say, Ed, is not that we heard a lot of expressions of support for it, but that if either party has the ability to invoke a mediation process from the beginning, literally, so if anybody who doesn't want to go through CEP just says, I want mediation.
I think... if we're going to have CEP, when we structure it, we're going to have to make sure it's a little bit more, a lot more transparent than it is. Because what we don't want is a formal settlement device that's completely opaque. Because when you go into a CEP, nobody in the outside world knows what's going on. And I know one of the things we've talked about establishing is a sort of precedent here, where people know what's going on, know what comes out of the structures. And the CEP is currently structured. Is a thing you go into, it's closed, there's ICON, there's you, there's no record, no transcript, and folks in the outside world and third parties that may be affected by the settlement negotiations never know what's going on inside of there, and there's no requirement to make any agreement in the CEP public. So I think if we're going to go down that road, we do have to take a look at how it's currently structured and try to make it a little bit more transparent and less opaque.
I think that is an excellent point, and we will. And that is definitely on the Workstream 2 list. Greg?
Thanks. It's Greg Shatton for the record. You know, looking back at what the CEP consists of, it is not mediation because there is no mediator, as far as I can tell. It's a discussion between the parties, which by definition is not mediation. We have not actually had the or taken this opportunity to review the cooperative engagement process to decide whether it is worth improving or could be improved. But I think that's actually a good point. With we may want to maybe this is probably a work, almost certainly a Workstream 2 issue, since Workstream 1 is about to doesn't have much time left in a sense. But I think the CEP should be examined. I think that turning the CEP into an actual mediation process with a mediator, a trained mediator, a trained neutral, would change the CEP substantially as well. I think the view of people who've been involved in the CEP has not been that it was a creative chance to resolve differences, and I think without a third party in there trying to make that happen and someone who's trained in that regard, it probably will continue to be viewed that way. So I guess my overarching point is that we should make review of the CEP a Workstream 2 issue, since talking about the IRP without talking about the CEP is like discussing the architecture of a building without looking at its ground and its walkways. So I think our review, in a sense, is incomplete by not having looked at the CEP. More specifically, I would suggest that the CEP should be a mediation process. So it's a thought about how to deal with that. Thanks.
Okay, that seems like a very good way to deal with it. The question of whether how the CEP functions, whether it can be fine-tuned and enhanced, or whether mediation is the way to deal with this altogether as a work stream to item. I take that on board, and I think that's an excellent suggestion. Okay. And then, so then the last thing here is that the, that we would create a subgroup assisted by council and appropriate experts to continue to work on implementation details. And so we just need to think about what exactly has to go into the bylaws change for Workstream 1. And then let's just talk a little bit more about this binding, non-binding, training, whatever. As I heard the comments, there was very, very strong support for making this binding. There was also some concern about what do you do if there's just a really bonehead decision. And so, you know, one of the suggestions was maybe there is a sort of, high threshold community acting through the sole member vote decision that says this is a bonehead decision that doesn't make any sense. You could have that you could phase in the binding nature over not time but number of cases. You could have a review, and I do think that people have expressed strong support for the notion that there would be a process to review the functioning of the independent review panel periodically. Other thoughts on that, David?
Thanks, Becky. I like the suggestion that you posited just a few minutes ago of a narrow, high-level community ability to say this decision makes no sense, and would suggest that if we went that route, the subgroup could come up with some kind of gating rules and description that would make it workable discreetly and narrowly and not undermine the IRP. But we have to recognize, and it's a good point to recognize, that panels from time to time come out with some real clunkers that make absolutely no sense. So I like the idea. Thank you.
Other thoughts? Okay. Thoughts in questions in general about this, and what I propose to do is to revise and expand this along the lines of to reflect our discussion this morning, and to sort of create the report, and then I will circulate it to Work Party 2 in advance, and I think that we will probably discuss it at the full group on the call on Thursday, so I guess I'm going to do that today. David, do you have a new hand or an old hand?
It's a new hand, just to say, and by the way, Becky, thank you for all this work that you do in revising these documents on short order. I think we should be prepared tomorrow too. We should anticipate the question of, well, when you speak of a subgroup, when you, the WP2, speak of a subgroup, can you tell us what you're talking about with respect to composition and time? I mean, there is the concern that Aubrey raises periodically that, you know, sometimes we're just creating things to kick things down the road. So I anticipate that will come up, and hopefully we can give that some thought today and be prepared to talk about it. Thank you.
Okay. I mean, look, I don't think that, you know, that we have done an awful lot of work here, but I do not think that we have a process that's ready to roll out, and there are a lot of details that need to be put down on paper. So I don't think that this is a kick the can. I think this is, you know, a very important, critical issue that we have to get right, and you know we're you know invoking the workstream one, workstream two part of this. So I think that the subgroup will have a very serious task on its hand, and it will involve a lot of work getting these rules and processes right. So I wouldn't want to minimize it. It's not going to be a walk in the park for those folks. Caboose?
Yes, Becky. I am in favor of the subgroup. It works very well for Working Party 1 that Jordan created several small group, design team or small group, and I think that that is a good idea in view of the limited time that we have. There should be few experts or few people who devote their time and come up with an idea that we could easily take it up in the next meeting. Thank you.
Thanks, Carlos. Okay. Other thoughts? How do we want to address, I think that the thing that, you know, we don't have cross constituencies, cross SOAC consensus on is the sort of binding or binding at the outset. I think I'll reflect the notion that there would be a very narrow opportunity for the community to overturn a decision that's a bonehead decision, and we'll talk about the ways in which the GAC's consultation rights can be respected in this process, and then I'm sure we'll have a lively discussion about it on that basis. I mean, this conversation was very helpful to me because I didn't understand that the nature of the GAC's concern, I think, addressing the concern that this does not undermine the consultation that they have under their advisory committee bylaws provisions makes sense. Kavutz, do you have a new hand?
Yes, Becky. Once again, the issue is quite simple. GAC is dealing with the public policy issues, and based on this, they provide advice with consensus. I says consensus advice. This goes to the ICANN. If they agree with that, so far so good. If they don't agree, they reject that. They should give the reason for the rejection. Nevertheless, they should come up find a solution. That means the issue will not be one-sided. Need to be a solution for that advice with address public policy issues, and that is an issue we would like to be maintained without any alteration, and we would like that the binding IRP would not have any impact on these negotiations and on these finding solutions. That is very, very simple, and there is no idea to give any additional advantage to the GAC. That is what has been worked for many, many years, and we would like to continue to work at a minimum. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavutz. And I think that's a very helpful clarification or articulation, at least for me. My question is this issue already addressed by the fact that the decision of an IRP is not going to specify exactly how ICANN reacts to responds to a decision that it's violated its bylaws. The ICANN board, subject to the guidance and the thinking in the independent review panel decision, will have to make a decision on how it's going to implement the decision. And nothing would preclude the GAC from providing advice on that at all. But if we accept the premise, as I think we do, that ICANN cannot violate its bylaws, I don't see how this process would cut off any of the GAC's existing rights. Greg?
Yeah, I think that, right now, clearly a decision that the board makes as a result of GAC advice, with or without consultation, can be challenged through an IRP. As long as the challenger has standing before the IRP, that can't change. That shouldn't change. The fact that it's quote unquote binding shouldn't somehow exempt those board decisions from the IRP. I'm not sure if that's the GAC's problem, that the GAC wants decisions that the board makes based on its advice to be unchangeable, through an IRP. But if it is, that's a grave concern. That would essentially mean that the Dot Africa decision couldn't have even been started in the first place. That would seem to me to be going in exactly the wrong direction of unaccountable, from an unaccountable board to an accountable board. That would leave the board unaccountable, perhaps anybody but the GAC, which is clearly not the direction that the multi-stakeholder community wants to go in. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't hear Cavus to be supporting the notion that anything would make a GAC, a board decision unreviewable. I hear him to be saying that, you know, if a decision was to come down, they would still want their ability to provide advice and engage with the ICANN board about how a decision is implemented. So the notion that something violates the bylaws, you know, ICANN can't act on GAC advice that requires it to violate the bylaws, that's just sort of a basic fundamental principle here. But maybe I could be wrong, and Cavus, you
yes.
have the ability to clear it up.
I'm very sorry. I see many words that when we put them all together, that frightening me, and I'm not comfortable. What we are saying, what I am saying is that IRP should not put in question the nature of the need for consultation of ICANN board to come to some sort of understanding and mutual agreement with the GAC if the GAC Act advice is not taken by the board. This is what I'm saying. IRP should not have any challenge or any imposition or any adverse effect to the nature of the consultation. That means consultation need to be undertaken by the board with the GAC with a view to arrive at an acceptable and satisfactory solution for any advice which provided with consensus today to the board. This is what I'm saying. I'm nothing else and nothing more. I don't think that we are talking a particular advantage and so on and so forth. Consultation is required and should result in some satisfactory solution. IRP should not have any impact on this process. Thank you.
So could I just ask a question, Cavus, and sort of pose a concrete scenario and see if we're understanding it. Suppose GAC provides consensus advice, the board and GAC engage in consultations and come up with a solution that is acceptable to the GAC and acceptable to the board. Someone could say, still, that solution violates the bylaws. That solution requires ICANN to take something, to do something that violates the bylaws. It requires ICANN to discriminate against somebody for no good reason, or it requires the board, to regulate in a way that is not permitted by the bylaws. So they could bring an IRP, and then the IRP panel would hear that, and they might say, okay, yes, that solution that you've come up with actually does require ICANN to act in a way that violates the bylaws. There's no reason that nothing would stop further consultation between the GAC and the board on how to address that issue. The GAC could provide advice, and that would trigger the obligation to negotiate. But the GAC and the board can't agree on matters that are outside the bylaws. And so all this says is if by chance they do that, they agree on something that would cause ICANN to violate the bylaws, the affected parties have a right to challenge that.
Yes, if you allow me to reply the question, you said that GAC provided an advice to ICANN, and ICANN did not accept that. They go to the negotiations, and negotiations end something satisfactory, both for GAC and for the ICANN. Then someone in the community may say that this is in violation of the bylaw. If they give the good reasons for that, that is in violation of bylaw to the IRRP, and then it was proved that it's violation of ICANN, still GAC and ICANN should continue their discussions with the view to comply with the provision of the bylaw. However, the negotiation should be continued and the advice should be taken. This is something that I cannot say at this stage. That is a very critical and delicate issue, requires further examination discussion. But the idea is that the consultation needs to be continued even if there is a motion of violation of the bylaw by ICANN to the community. That would not end the consultation. The consultation needs to be continued, taking account of the view of the community in a possible or likelihood of violation of bylaw in order to correct the issue, but that does not put an end to the consultation. Consultation needs to be continued in order to have a satisfactory solution consistent with the ICANN bylaw and so on and so forth for the advice which was given by consensus. This is a very, very preliminary idea but needs to be further developed. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's entirely workable, and I think that your explanation and clarification has been very helpful to me, at least to understand what the GAC's concern is and to understand what we need to do to reassure the GAC that their consultation rights do not get cut off here. So I think this has been a very helpful and very good discussion. Thank you very much. And I see there's a similar conversation going on in the chat. Okay. I feel much better because I feel like the one area where we could potentially have a really big problem, we have some new clarification and insights on, and hopefully we'll be better able to address them going forward. Any other closing comments from the group? Just to let you know, we will be circulating a draft of the responses and revised reconsideration request section. We should be doing that shortly. I am not sure that we're going to have we will have an opportunity to discuss it next week. I'm a little confused about the timing, but in any case, we do want to get a discussion going on the list thing.
Becky,
okay.
I have a suggestion, if you allow me.
Yes.
Yeah. I just make this point as a participant. When we deal with the ICANN, with the board, with the GAC advice to the ICANN, and at the end saying that after the rejection, there should be some sort of consultations in order to arrive at satisfactory solutions, we could add to arrive to a satisfactory solution for both GAC and ICANN, we should add consistent with ICANN bylaw. That means this satisfactory solution in no way should contradict the bylaw. It is very simple and very legal and very constitutional, rather than getting in some sort of thing. I understand that even GAC and board may decide something which may be inconsistent with the bylaw. That should be corrected because there should be accountability. Nevertheless, the discussion should continue until the time that a satisfactory solution is found. No doubt we should add, comma, consistent with the ICANN bylaw. That means any solution should be consistent with the bylaw. That is quite clear legally. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. That makes perfect sense to me. Okay. Thank you very much for a very, very good discussion this morning. Please look for something for me later today. And I have a good rest of the day. Thanks, everybody.